This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play Music, or wherever you'd like to get your podcast on, and please rate and review us wherever you listen. In the culture wars playing out on the nation's college and university campuses, Chapman University, a mid-sized private university about 90 minutes south of Los Angeles, is one of the combat zones. The university received $15 million to fund the Smith Institute, which seeks to bring the study of economics and of the humanities together in a way that both sides benefit from. The Smith Institute is named both for Adam Smith, widely considered the father of economics, and Vernon Smith, the winner of the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics. Because one-third of the money came from the Charles Koch Foundation, some students and faculty at Chapman are protesting the Institute and demanding that the university return the gift. Across the country, in fact, groups called Uncoke My Campus are pushing for schools to return any money from the libertarian philanthropists Charles and David Koch, arguing that any such funding comes with ideological strings. Now, I should note that the Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes this podcast, receives money from the Koch Foundation, and David Koch has been on our board of trustees for over 25 years. But does funding actually dictate university research and teaching? And in an age when the humanities, the study of history, literature, art, philosophy, and more, is rapidly declining, what are the best ways to revive interest in the very activities that make us, well, human? Today, I'm very happy to be talking with the president of Chapman University, Daniele Struppa, the 13th president of that school, and a mathematician by training. Earlier this year in the Wall Street Journal, he forcefully defended the Smith Institute and funding from the Kochs, writing, and I quote, "I am being asked to turn down donations from the dreaded Koch brothers, even when, as in this case, the proposal for funding was inspired, developed, and fully fleshed out by my faculty in the most important exercise of their own academic freedom. The demand that research funding be declined because of its origin poses a grave threat to academic freedom." Daniele Struppa, welcome to the Reason Podcast.
Thank you. I like the quote.
So why are the opponents of funding from the Koch brothers or other private citizens, and foundations that they might run, why are they wrong when they say that funding obviously comes with strings and it obviously is going to dictate what gets taught and what gets researched at universities?
Well, yeah, I'm a mathematician, and to me it's very important to look at facts. So the claim is funding from private sources has strings attached and will influence the research. So we have to look if that's the case. I've shown the agreement that we have with the Koch Foundation to the president of our faculty senate and to the editor-in-chief of our school newspaper. And they
the
had
Panther.
The Panther, that's right.
Why the Panther?
That's the mascot of the university, Pete the Panther, yeah. And I'm glad he's not a controversial mascot, so I'm happy with the
yes,
Panther.
That's right. Could be a lot worse.
And when they saw it, they completely agreed with me. There is no string attached whatsoever. So the counter, when this became publicly known, then the second position of those in opposition to the funding was, well, yeah, but I'm sure there is a wink and a nod. Hmm. Well, to me, that is it's kind of an unethical accusation, because we shouldn't be allowed to make accusations that cannot be disproved. You can't say, if you say that I stole your car yesterday, I have an opportunity to show that yesterday I was not here, that I was with my wife, and so I can get out of it. But if you accuse me of having stolen $100 without saying when, how, and where, it's impossible for me to prove that I never did it. And so this kind of accusation is not an acceptable one. The fundamental point, which is, I'm happy you quoted my article in the Wall Street Journal, is that this is a proposal that our faculty did. Vernon Smith, who got a Nobel Prize, and two of his colleagues, Jan Osborne and Bart Wilson, they came up with a proposal. Interestingly enough, the proposal was supported by the faculty senate. So the opposition only arose after the proposal was supported financially by the Koch brothers.
So it's not the proposal itself,
no.
It's the funding. And let me, in the Orange County Register, you had a great quote where somebody was challenging this, and you said, Vernon Smith has a freaking Nobel Prize. If I told him, don't take Koch money, that would violate his academic freedom. He's not asking for money from the mafia. So the mafia, that's a line too far?
I guess that would be a line.
Okay, yeah. One of the things that I want to ask you about is, to describe the aims of the Smith Institute, because, sure, apart from the funding controversy and, probably at a dozen or more schools around the country that have received some money from the Koch brothers in one form or another, there's been controversy. But the Smith Institute is kind of fascinating. And before I let you answer, I do, in the interest of full disclosure, I should let our audience know that my ex-wife, Catherine Gillespie, a feminist scholar of 17th century British and colonial American literature, is teaching now at Chapman. She's working with the Smith Institute as a full professor in the fall, and so will her husband, Michael Moses, who I actually introduced her to and who spent the past 30 years teaching English at Duke, and he's contributed to Reason over the years. But what is the goal of the Smith Institute and this conversation they want to have about humanomics,
right,
and why is that important?
Well, I think maybe we should take a step back and look at what Vernon did 60 years ago now. So he realized something that most people don't fully understand, that the economic decisions we make are not separate from aspects of our humanity. So he actually, one of his very early papers, and I'm not going to describe the detail, but it's a paper in which he shows that people make decisions which are counter to their immediate interests. And they're probably due to the fact that they have some degree of trust in the fact that the person with which they're working will reciprocate. Now, this, if you think from the point of view of the rational agent, shouldn't work the way. You and I never met, and now why would I trust that you'll do good because I did good?
This is the Italian in you speaking.
That's the Italian in me. And so I think that experiment made it very clear to Vernon, I think might have been the first sign that you cannot do economics and separate it from what makes us human. And what makes us human is the fact that we like to be part of a community. We want to cooperate. We want to reward those who have expressed trust in us. These are absolutely human traits, and you cannot just do economics and ignore them. So now we move forward, and the Institute is really devoted to showing that these two fundamental questions, how do we make a nation rich and what makes a good human being, are connected. So these, of course, are the titles of the two books of Adam Smith, right, on the Wealth of Nations and the Theory of Moral Sentiments. It's kind of interesting if you think about it. These are apparently completely different topics. And the Institute is dedicated to demonstrate or study that why these two topics are not as different as they think. And one of the things they do, and the courses that I've seen are really incredible, they bring to bear the close reading of fundamental texts of literature to see how you can substantiate this kind of connection. So this year, for example, the faculty that are leading the summer seminar are reading the Faust of Goethe.
Mm-hmm. And Goethe's Faust.
I'm sorry?
Goethe's Faust. Yeah. Yes.
They look at that from the point of view of understanding what are the kind of economical considerations that emerge and how they can help you understand some of the key questions that the Faust poses. For example, why is Faust saved at the end? He makes a deal with the devil.
I'm sorry. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
Okay.
Oh, that's right.
Faust is saved at the end. Okay.
So he makes a deal with the devil. He does what he promised the devil would lead to his damnation, and yet he's saved. So why is that? That's a difficult question. We don't have a clear answer. But that's the kind of stuff that they look at. And to me, those are exactly the kind of courses. I think I wrote this in the Wall Street Journal. That can bring a lot of new vitality in the humanities because it brings them closer to things that matter to us as humans.
It's fascinating to me that it's kind of taken, you mentioned Adam Smith has two, classic works. And I think in the libertarian movement, broadly speaking, we spend a lot more time on the Wealth of Nations than on the Moral Sentiments, although that's been coming up. And why has it taken us 250 years, or not us, but economists, to realize that, okay, well, we're dealing with human beings here, and right, human beings
have psychology. Human beings create art and literature, and they care about history, and all of this stuff shapes us. One of the things that I found really interesting in the Orange County Register article, which I'll put up online in the text field of this podcast, when the reporter went to students to say, well, what about these humanomics courses? Are they agenda laden? Are they trying to get you to believe in deregulation of the natural gas industry or anything? The students were just mostly saying, you know, these are interesting courses and ideas that I hadn't encountered before, and they made me think. You know, and I realize you're probably not in on the weeds of the reviews, you know, the student feedback on these courses, but is there a sense that the students are really into this type of work?
Oh, absolutely. The students love these courses. In fact, you're right. Generally speaking, I'm not in the weeds. In this particular case, I did look at the reviews because obviously, being that there is a controversy, I want to make sure I had the full piece of information. Students love these classes, and they loved it because, as you said, they discover things that they never thought of before, and things that are not obvious. In a sense, they discovered, you know, 2 weeks ago, I participated in one of the classes because since the course is about Faust, Bart and Jen wanted to have the student listen to Symphony No. 8 of Gustav Mahler, which puts in music the very ending of the Faust. And I'm a huge Mahler fanatic. So I gave a half an hour introduction to Mahler No. 8. I wish those who oppose this program were there. This was a spectacular conversation between me and the students, many of which had never listened to Mahler before, and the two other teachers. And
we were Mahler, and just so I'm getting this right, he was the original drummer in the Beatles, right? And
yeah,
they picked
right.
him out for Ringo Starr. But yeah, this is
1860, 1910.
Isn't it bizarre that you know, the university, which, you know, the idea that knowledge is somehow integrated across disciplines? It must be exciting at Chapman to actually be dealing with a kind of reintegration. And I say this as somebody who was trained in the humanities. What, you know, you mentioned that part of what is good here is that it brings vitality to the humanities. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about that. How does putting the humanities in the context of, say, economics or psychology help?
Well, if you read, as I have to do every day, the Chronicle of Higher Education, it's an endless litany of desperation for the fact that nobody cares about the humanities are losing funding, students don't want the humanities are, what is their purpose? So there is a lot of soul searching there. Now, one of the things is that when nobody wants to study a topic or when a topic seems to be losing relevance, it's because obviously people are unable to display that relevance. And I think that what this humanomics is doing is giving another hook, so to speak, so that you get into the humanities. It's very hard to tell a student, okay, you're going to have to read the Faust. I mean, it's a gigantic piece of work. It's very hard. It's filled with philosophy and metaphysics and references to complicated historical facts. But now if you put it in a framework of trying to understand an economics problem, it opens up a door. That, you know, I teach math, and so I always am prey of the same problem. How do I make my math relevant to the student? How can I teach an entire semester and make sure the kids don't lose track of why this is beautiful and important? So that's a job that I always have to do. And I think that that's what's happening with the humanities. Now, this doesn't have to be the only way. That's the other thing. We are not saying, hey, if you want to teach humanities, you have to do humanomics. Not at all. But this is one way. And I'm a little saddened that people are unwilling to recognize
it. Well, and the worst, the people who are most outraged are in the humanities, right?
Yeah.
Because somehow it's like we don't have any majors, we can't get any funding, we're losing status and resources within the university. Along comes something that might help that, and then they're like, get out of here.
Absolutely.
You know
what,
I know Michael Moses told me, again, who's been teaching at Duke University since the late 80s, when he started there was something like 1,000 English majors at Duke, and now there are under 50 full-time English majors. That is catastrophic.
It
and
is.
If you care about literature, and the, you know, literature, English is doing better than French or art history,
right,
or, you know, the classics. I mean,
and that's a tragedy for our nation. I mean, because I was trained in humanities. I did the classical studies in Italy in a high school, Greek, Latin, literature, philosophy. Those are fundamental component of the education of somebody that lives in modern society. So the fact that we are losing them, it's a tragedy. And the fact that we're becoming so utilitarian, so to speak, that unless we know what's the job you're going to get and students don't want to do it, that's terrible. So we need to use every possible avenue to reinsert them in the core. And this is one of those avenues. And unfortunately, some of the most ridiculous criticism that this program has received is that the professors are paid by the Koch Foundation to instill ideas so that the Koch brothers will make more money with their fossil fuels. Now, the Koch brothers, they don't need Chapman University to make a lot of money. They obviously have made a lot of money on their own. How can we think that having two new teachers in the English department is designed so that these teachers will convince the students to eventually become policymakers and make policies that will allow the brothers to have more oil?
Well, I just heard you give a lecture about Antonio Gramsci. Yeah. So maybe that's what they're thinking, that this is the beginning of a kind of libertarian, long, slow march through the institutions, and that it starts with a Nobel Prize winning economics getting flipped, almost like a Soviet agent, like Donald Trump. There's a P tape, an ideological P tape of Vernon Smith. He's been turned by the Kochs, and in 100 years, the universities will all be what? I mean, they'll be interested in literature and economics.
I think that there is a lot of fear of that. There is another article that appeared on the Orange County Register maybe a week ago from one of the colleagues that is in opposition to the project. And even some of the quotes in the article that you are referring to, they talk about how this infiltrates the Department of English, and then people will do that. There is another absurdity in this accusation, which I pointed out to my colleagues. Both Moses and
Catherine,
they already had jobs before. So why? I told them, why would the brothers, who are obviously good business people, waste their money to infiltrate people who are already infiltrated? One of them is a Duke, the other was at Ohio. So I would understand if there was an infiltration of a bunch of postdocs, and you're saying, you know, we are trying to set up the stage for the postdoc to have positions. These are people who already have positions. There is no, it's an accusation that makes no intellectual sense. Why, what is the interest of the Koch in moving these people to Chapman, where we already have Vernon Smith that propagates the virus of libertarianism?
Let me flip the question, too, about humanomics or about the Smith Institute and your vision of a university where there, you know, knowledge across different disciplines and across the research sciences, social sciences, and humanities are integrated. What does economics, what does mathematics, what does biology gain by that, you know, kind of having better knowledge or being integrated with the humanities discipline?
Well, in a way that you may think sort of paradoxical, but for example, I always consider mathematics a form of humanities. People think of math as a technique to solve problems. Yeah, and in so doing, they forget that mathematics has always been extremely connected to other activities that we would recognize as activities of the spirit of the humanities. In fact, I'm writing a book with a friend on this, and you know, projective geometry arose from the desire of the painters in the Renaissance to understand how to draw halos in ways that were realistic. If you look at before the arrival of perspective, everybody has a halo which is round, even when they're turning the wrong way. So it clearly don't make sense.
And I love the idea of a realistic halo.
Exactly.
I don't want one of those fake halos.
Exactly. Yeah. It's going to be the real halo.
Yeah.
The angels have halos. And so how do you do it? Of course, because they're ellipses if you're looking from a different perspective. So that's one example. Navigation developed incredible mathematical instruments. So I think that rebringing back the connection between even technical disciplines to the humanities provides a tremendous amount of life. I teach almost exclusively these kind of classes at Chapman. I teach different math classes every year, but they're all about the connection between the humanities and math. This past year, I taught a class with a colleague of mine who is a professor of philosophy at the Sorbonne. And the class was on a very simple topic, numbers. And we fought over every single detail. And the student realized that even numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, it's not such a trivial concept, that for mankind to understand what a number is was a gigantic step, and that people can have different perspective as to what that really means. And that, to me, enlarges their brain in ways that are spectacular.
Before you were at Chapman, you were at George Mason University.
Yeah,
so
money,
obviously you,
money
had, yeah, you, have, you have retroviruses coursing through your entire body. But when you take a longer view of the university and its role in contemporary American life, you know, because one hears all the time about how states are cutting funding to public universities, and all universities get a ton of public money through student loans and Pell Grants and other types of research grants for faculty. Are you optimistic about the university as an institution in America, or are you kind of scared shitless that we're morphing into either a utilitarian program where it's essentially vocational and technical, you know, work or education for maybe post-industrial workers, or that kind of conversation and discourse is being shut down and regimented so much that, you know, the smartest people aren't going into the university, either as students or as faculty?
Mm-hmm. I'm actually an optimist, but I think it's our job. It's a job of people like in my position as president to stand up for this kind of freedom and to fight against the utilitarian aspect, because we are under that pressure too. Every university is. But I think in the long run, I believe that we're going to see consolidation of institutions. The one at the very bottom in terms of financial solidity will disappear. Other will consolidate. And that's probably good, because there are probably too many. So there is going to be some market adjustment. But I believe that the institution will remain, because there is a lot of stuff that we can still say. But it's up to presidents, frankly, and to their faculty to fight so that we maintain this vibrant intellectual discourse. I can tell you, students love that. Students resonate very well. Yesterday night, I had 30 students in my home, and we do this every summer. And one of the students was so excited, because she said, you know, my parents are excited that I'm here because they remember you. They talk with you. And I said, wow, nice. And I didn't remember. And she said, no, I can't.
And you're just having them over to, like, cut your grass and clean your gutters.
Right, exactly. I mean, so, yeah. It's unpaid labor.
Yes.
And, of course, they also get plenty of food.
Right.
And she said, no, but the parent told me that you talked with them about the Epic of Gilgamesh. And it turns out that her parents are Assyrian. And so I remember the conversation we had about the Assyrian Empire. And those things impact these kids. And they realize the importance. The Epic of Gilgamesh, nobody ever told me it was going to serve me well in my job as a president. It obviously did, because they said my parents were unsure between the two universities, but they were so taken by the discussion they had with you. And they said, this is the place where we want you to go. And this is a student in biology. So I'm...
And of course, Gilgamesh is partly about biology.
Yeah.
It's about life extension.
Absolutely.
And longevity. So,
and you know, despite all the negative stuff that we see, despite the terrible example we get from Washington D.C., I maybe that's why I'm a professor. I believe in culture being the best way for human spirit to rise, and I'm just not going to give it up. We keep doing it.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Daniele Struppi. He's the president of Chapman University. This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, and hope to be in the future, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play Music, or wherever you like to listen to podcasts. And wherever that is, please rate and review us. Thanks for listening.